Hello there. Today is Friday, October 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the president's chief of staff comes to his defense and how he dealt with a fallen serviceman's family.
And in his way, tried to express that opinion. He's a brave man, a fallen hero.
The latest on the Russia investigation. The Me Too phenomenon still making waves. And also ahead, the Country Music Television Artist of the Year Awards took place this week in a very untraditional way. It's all on today's International Edition. White House Chief of Staff John Kelly defended President Trump's handling of the deaths of U.S. service members and delivered an intensely emotional rebuke to those who he accused of politicizing the issue. Speaking at a White House press briefing Thursday, Kelly reacted to U.S. Congresswoman Frederica Wilson, who accused Trump of being insensitive to the mother of a fallen soldier during a recent phone call.
I was stunned when I came to work yesterday morning and brokenhearted at what I saw a member of Congress doing. A member of Congress who listened in on a phone call from the President of the United States to a young wife, and in his way tried to express that opinion. He's a brave man, a fallen hero. He knew what he was getting himself into because he enlisted. There's no reason to enlist. He enlisted. And he was where he wanted to be, exactly where he wanted to be, with exactly the people he wanted to be with when his life was taken. That was the message. That was the message that was transmitted.
Sergeant LaDavid Johnson and three other U.S. special forces were killed by Islamic State-linked militants earlier this month in an incident near the Niger-Mali border. Kelly recalled the words that officials told him when his own son died from a roadside bomb while on patrol in Afghanistan in 2010, saying he was doing exactly what he wanted to do when he was killed. He knew what the possibilities were when he went to war.
There's not much that really can take the edge off what a family member is going through. So some presidents have elected to call. All presidents, I believe, have elected to send letters. If you elect to call a family like this, it is about the most difficult thing you could imagine. There's no perfect way to make that phone call.
Trump's handling of the deaths of service members became the subject of controversy after he was asked Monday why he hadn't commented on the deaths of the soldiers killed in Niger. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. Puerto Rico's governor calls for equal treatment after the hurricane. Senate Republicans plan an Iran nuclear deal strategy. White nationalist Richard Spencer is shouted down at the University of Florida during a speech. And a U.S. appeals court puts on hold an undocumented teen's abortion. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Well, we turn now to our social media segment, and for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Andrew, what are we talking about today?
Lori, it is the same story, different day, of course. We're talking about, perpetually talking about, Russia's interference in the U.S. presidential election in 2016 and Russian influence on social media. And we're not just talking about this. The U.S. Senate is talking about this because there's a new piece of legislation that was announced on Thursday that looks to police social media content that's posted by foreign entities.
Interesting.
It's called the Honest Ads Act, and it's being sponsored by Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar and Democratic Senator Mark Warner. And it's already receiving bipartisan support from a big name in the Senate. Republican Senator John McCain is one of the bill's co-sponsors. Now, this act seeks to require that political ads online follow the same rules as political ads on TV and radio. So it's going to require social networks and web companies to keep public record of all the ads that are purchased on their platforms, everything from when the ad was purchased, how much was spent, who specifically was targeted, and how many people saw it. And it's also going to require those companies to make efforts to prevent foreign entities or foreign agents from purchasing political advertisements, which is not allowed in the United States. So this is surely the first of many steps we're going to see. We've already seen some steps on the part of the social media networks, this is the first step we're really seeing legislatively from the U.S. Congress when it comes to policing this content online, and I imagine that there will be more forthcoming. Now, that bill comes as we're seeing more and more just how widespread the scope of this Russian influence and interference was, because there are reports, Lori, that a Twitter account that appeared to be affiliated with the Republican Party in the U.S. state of Tennessee was actually run by Russian. Now, this Twitter account got a lot of attention during the 2016 presidential election. In fact, it was retweeted and referenced by dozens of politicians and celebrities and other notable people, not to mention the thousands of people that were following this on Twitter and thought it was authentic. In fact, we're also learning that members of the Trump campaign also shared tweets from that account thinking it was real in the lead-up to the 2016 presidential election. And on top of that, there are reports that that account stayed on Twitter for months even after the actual Republican Party of Tennessee asked for it to be taken down because it was impersonating them. Now, it should be said, there are no indications that either the Trump campaign or Twitter realized that this account was being run by Russians. But the fact that this account was so widely accepted shows just how deep this infiltration went. And the fact that we're hearing about this now shows what a major part of the presidential election it was and what a major part of social media it still is. So hence the reason for that legislation that we talked about and the reason that this is being, or trying to be at least, curtailed online.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. You can follow him on Twitter at APAL. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. And while the social media aspects of Russian meddling into our election is being dealt with by the Senate, a bigger investigation continues as special counsel Mueller just this week interviewed several former Trump administration aides. Joining us now to talk more about that is former CIA agent and criminal defense attorney Jack Rice. So, Jack, what does it say that the special counsel has now interviewed former White House spokesman Sean Spicer and other top White House aides?
It says that Mueller's team is really digging into this issue to try to determine exactly what's going on. We don't know exactly what it is that Sean Spicer knows, but what we do know is that at minimum, he was a very close observer to what was going on. And the ability to talk about what he saw, the conversations that he heard between others, can then be used to cross-reference what other people have actually said. So we can all of a sudden take a look at what Page was doing. We can look at what Manafort was doing. We can look at what Flynn was doing and on and on and on, which will then support potentially obstruction charges or other issues that are out there.
He also interviewed former Chief of Staff Reince Priebus and Keith Kellogg, the Executive Secretary of National Security Council. So he's definitely digging in. My understanding is that Sean Spicer was a fanatic about taking notes. He took notes about everything. Obviously, Mr. Mueller's taking notes. And if any of these people, like Sean Spicer, don't tell the truth or their stories don't corroborate with the others, would you say somebody could potentially go to prison for just lying to this federal investigation?
In fact, that's what I expect. It's going to be difficult sometimes to establish conspiracy. I mean, it just is. The standards are higher and you need a lot of very specific information. But what you can establish is obstruction. When you find that somebody says one thing when in fact others will support that in fact wasn't true, that's what we have seen over and over again. Those are frequently the charges where people are actually indicted. And so the idea that you would talk to somebody like a Sean Spicer really supports that concept. And you're right, he was a note taker. The importance of that issue is if he took notes about something that was going on at the time, those notes could very likely be admissible in a courtroom. So you get all of those notes, you turn around and not just highlight the notes, but enhance off those with those investigations, with those conversations. That could be invaluable in terms of going after others, even if Spicer is completely clean and completely honest and wasn't involved. Again, that's part of the investigation. But his ability to reach up and talk about and highlight and illuminate what else is going on could be invaluable to Mueller's team.
But who do you think these folks will be loyal to? Do you think that they will go in there? You know, we don't know Sean Spicer lied during his press briefings, but it would appear that he backed up the president when there were proven falsehoods stated by the president. So what does a person in a situation like that do? Is he likely to look out for himself now or continue to align himself with the president regardless?
Of course Sean Spicer lied, and you can shine this up all you want, but in fact, he was telling things that were verifiably false. But the real question in this case is, how loyal will he be to the President of the United States? I think one aspect of this, which makes it really interesting in my mind, is that what we have determined is that President Trump is not loyal to anybody but President Trump. And the thing is that may have a that may be a real problem for this president, because everybody in the room recognizes that he doesn't have their back, which means they may not be motivated to have his back. But I think there's a broader conversation that's being had right now, and that question is if this president goes down, what is the narrative? What does that mean? And the real question may likely be, is it time to actually not support this president, not be loyal to this president, but be loyal to the party? And so there may be internal conversations within the RNC and with the likes of a Sean Spicer and Priebus and others who are longstanding operatives of the party itself, that the purpose at this point is to be loyal to the party, because if there's blood in the water and it is this president's blood, he can't pull down the party with him. He needs to go down alone. That's the question that people are asking, and that's the question that I think will be addressed in the coming months, because it has to be.
The president and the White House have been really pushing for these investigations to wrap up. Do you think that they are close to conclusion?
These investigations are going to take their own course. As I've said, Mueller is a pro. His people are pros, and they have been doing this for decade after decade, and they have been able to reach into both parties, and people in Capitol Hill, people inside the Beltway know that. And so they are going to keep digging. And the real question becomes, are they going to stop at the initial questions of the Russians, or are they pushing this beyond that issue? And so the question becomes, does this stop at the issue of the Russians digging into an election, or does it push into operations in Russia in the past, or does it deal with issues of obstruction and suppression? Those are the questions that people are asking right now. That's the question that I think Mueller is trying to decide. How much further do I go?
All right. Former CIA agent, criminal defense attorney Jack Rice, thank you for your perspective. Well, police in Los Angeles have launched an investigation into Hollywood movie producer Harvey Weinstein involving a possible sexual assault in 2013. And the Weinstein scandal is really being seen by many as another watershed moment. Since the story broke more than a week ago, some 30 women from lesser-known names to megastars have emerged to recount disturbing experiences. And there's been a growing movement that has evolved into a bigger conversation about how so many women have dealt with the same issues. Joining me to talk more about this is Catherine Blakeman, Director of Communications at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. Who knew when Alyssa Milano, you know, said, hey, if this has ever happened to you, tweet me too, it would turn into what it has turned into. Are you surprised?
I am not surprised given the research that we've seen and the stories that we've heard, but I'm really not surprised because what we do at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation is look at the connections between all forms of sexual exploitation. And what we're living in today is a pornified, hypersexualized culture. I haven't met Harvey Weinstein. I can't guarantee that he is, you know, a consumer of pornography, but what I can guarantee you is that he and other similar perpetrators of these types of abuses are products of our pornified and hypersexualized culture. So in that sense, I'm not surprised.
But it's pretty amazing that it has taken off the way it has. I mean, just the amount of people that responded is quite a statement.
It is a statement, and I think it's also a testament. I think this is a really amazing wake-up call and a really powerful moment for women in Hollywood. They are so powerful. They are such culture creators, for better or for worse. And in this movement, they've taken this opportunity to do something really, really good. And, you know, in many regards, we look at the movies and the productions that Hollywood creates, and a lot of times sexual violence or, you know, men being, you know, dominating over women in a sexual way is portrayed in a sort of glorified, sort of normalized way. And what we're seeing is that actually, in reality, this is actually happening to these women behind the scenes in their real lives. It's not just this glamorous, you know, playboy lifestyle that these men are living out, that these movie characters are living out, and it's glamorous and, you know, it's all okay, and it's all okay in the end. It's really not. And these women are, because they were brave and they spoke out, I think it's up to 12 million women who have tweeted or written on Facebook about this, And it's women who were silent for years or decades even, who didn't feel comfortable sharing their stories before. So I see what you're saying. In that way, in that regard, it is surprising.
And it's interesting, too, because it's gone global.
To me, when you say it's gone global, that's a testament to, you know, we live in a fallen world. That's my worldview. It's not a perfect world. But it's also a testament to how pervasive the pornified culture has gone on a global scale. And we live in a global sort of economy. There's a lot of cross-culturalization because of the internet and things that people are exposed to on the internet.
We know that it's really, really caught on fire, and a lot of people are hoping that this won't just be the topic of the week.
Absolutely, absolutely. Alyssa Milano, who is the woman who, you know, basically started this campaign. I don't think she created the Me Too hashtag. I think another activist created that about a decade ago for a similar cause, if I'm not mistaken. But nonetheless, she brought it back to life in this moment in history. And she herself said just today, I don't want this to just be the next Twitter trend that just dies. This isn't just a joke or something funny on Twitter. This is huge. This is impacting so many women's lives. And, you know, at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, we have what we call our Dirty Dozen list. And this isn't just a Harvey Weinstein problem. This isn't just, Roger Ailes or Bill Cosby. These are men that we see in the spotlight that have been affected by our pornified culture. But we look at mainstream companies like Amazon and Twitter. We purchase things on Amazon. Here's the thing. They have, really hardcore pornography films and magazines. Hmm. They even have books featuring eroticized child nudity, sex dolls with childlike features. These are things that are corrosive to the culture. And they're being delivered straight to your home through mainstream corporations, things we think of as completely safe and normal. And, Twitter, same thing. There's users on Twitter distribute hardcore adult pornography and even often child pornography. And, they promote prostitution. These are things that Twitter, we've written to the chief executive officer at Twitter. We've written to, Jeff Bezos at Amazon.com. We've told them, look, we've identified these issues with your corporations. You need to do something about this and take some responsibility for your massive impact on the culture. And so this isn't just a Hollywood problem. I've seen a ton of media saying a ton of things about how corrupt Hollywood is and, how deep this problem goes in Hollywood. Well, let's take a look at the broader culture, too, because if it was just Hollywood, we wouldn't have 12 million tweets and Facebook posts. And people can come to our website, which is endsexualexploitation.org, and find our Dirty Dozen list and ways that they can become activists on these issues.
All right. We appreciate your perspective. Catherine Blakeman, Director of Communications at the National Center on Sexual Exploitation. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Have you heard the latest news? In Mali, what is the Golden Voice of Africa doing in the U.S.? In Ghana, who came out on top at the Ghana Music Awards?
You're too short to be telling tall tales. Look at me.
Who's dropping a new album featuring Afrobeat original Tony Allen? Find out all of this and more this Sunday. You're going to love my interview with Salif Keita. And happy 60th, Ghana. It's music time in Africa. Tune in to VOA Africa's FM station, Sunday, 1500 and 2000 UTC.
VOA's International Edition continues now. Human Flow. It's a documentary by internationally acclaimed artist and activist Ai Weiwei, highlighting the plight of refugees around the world. The Chinese dissident captures the massive flow of humanity on our planet using drones. He filmed in 23 countries in 40 different refugee camps, people fleeing war, environmental crises, and religious persecution. VOA's Penelope Pulu spoke with the artist.
Being a refugee is much more than a political status. It is the most pervasive kind of cruelty that can be exercised against a human being. You are forcibly robbing this human being of all aspects that would make human life not just tolerable, but meaningful in many ways.
According to the documentary Human Flow, over 65 million people in the world today have been forcibly displaced from their homes. Using cameras attached to drones, Ai Weiwei films humanity's movement from up high.
Human flow as always happens in the human history. It's, in many cases, it's part of our humanity and our civilization.
But the social anomaly of our times, says the filmmaker, is the effort by countries to stem that flow by preventing refugees from crossing borders and integrating into new societies. After a harrowing sea voyage and days of walking, many refugees from the Middle East make their way to northern Greece, only to be stopped on its border with Macedonia.
Over 70 borders are built up their fences and walls, and forbidden any refugee to pass through. So by doing that, they really not only stopped the lifeline of those refugees to find a safe place, even just temporarily across the border and go to another location, but also put them in extreme dangerous condition.
2 months old and born here, but he didn't have any vaccination, no showering facilities. The hygienic situation is very bad.
Ai's look at the refugee crisis is as intimate as it is global. Human flow shows masses fleeing wars, religious persecution, and environmental disasters. Ai Weiwei warns if we don't save those people from displacement, entire generations born without identity, prospects for a better life or a country, will be vulnerable to extremism and radicalization.
Those people, those child, when they grow up, they only see how their parents being badly treated, unfairly treated. The world watching but not doing anything. What kind of image would remain in their mind?
Penelope Poulou, VOA News, Washington.
Country Music Television or CMT Artist of the Year Awards took place this week, but in light of the Las Vegas mass shooting and disaster hurricanes, CMT ditched their traditional ceremony. Nikki Strong joins International Edition's Sarah Williams to talk more about it.
Well, the honorees were Keith Urban, Luke Bryan, Chris Stapleton, Jason Aldean, and Florida Georgia Line. But instead of like accolades and performances that pay tribute to these artists and their accomplishments, CMT decided to switch the focus to those who have been recovering from the hurricanes and wildfires and the Las Vegas mass shooting. So the event turned into a night of, quote, hope and healing through the power of music. So there were no formal award presentations or tributes to the honorees. Instead, the honorees shared heartfelt messages to the fans. Artists performed somber tributes and songs of encouragement and inspirations. Overall, I thought it was really effective and well done.
What were your favorite moments?
There were several. I'll try to just share a few. One of them was the opening monologue in which the honorees spoke as a group live on stage, and one by one, collectively, they pretty much paid homage to their fans, the country music community, and their unwavering commitment to the genre, the overall power of the human spirit, especially when it comes to selflessly helping others and to overcome in difficult times, the power of music to facilitate healing, and the power of unity, the overall ability to get through any tragedy or disaster, natural or otherwise, when we all come together. And it really set the tone for the whole event. Another moment was when Chris Stapleton performed Broken Halos. Oh. Broken Halos, They Used to Fly. When I just heard the song, it just resonated with me really differently. And apparently he's been singing the song in tribute to the Las Vegas victims while he's been on the road. Another great moment was Luke Bryan's words about Jason Aldean. As we know, Jason Aldean was on stage during the shooting when it went out and began. He was actually on stage. And he's been sort of like the face of country music of that tragedy, of the Las Vegas shooting. And he's spoken. He took a couple of days off. He had to cancel shows. And so Luke Bryan, he said these words, and I really appreciated it. He talked about it could have been any one of them on stage performing. And he said, Aldean has responded with dignity, care, respect, and in some ways, defiance. And he was really proud of them. And I think that really does capture Jason Aldean's response. And on that note, when the finale came, Jason Aldean performed with Keith Urban, Chris Stapleton, and Little Big Town, and they did a cover of Tom Petty's I Won't Back Down. So, Wow. Yeah, it's symbolic in many ways because it pays tribute to a legend who was very instrumental and influenced so many artists in country music. But it's also important to note that this was the song after Jason Aldean canceled some shows. This was the first song he performed. He did a performance on the television show Saturday Night Live, and he performed that song, I Won't Back Down, as a rallying cry, really. Mm-hmm. And they ended on that note. So it was good.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at VOANews.com. Thank you very much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Zainab Abdulrahman. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States applauds the courage, determination, and will of the Venezuelan people who tried to exercise their constitutional right to vote in the October 15th gubernatorial elections. Candidates loyal to the authoritarian regime of President Nicolas Maduro claimed victory for 18 of 23 governorships contested in the October 15th elections, according to the regime-controlled National Electoral Council, or CNE. But opposition leaders rejected both the process and the tally, citing exit polls that indicate their candidates won many more states. Opposition members decried that voting sites were shifted to distant neighborhoods at the last minute, confusing and imposing barriers to voters in opposition strongholds. The government-stacked CNE issued bad-faith, misleading ballots, including opposition candidates who already lost in the primaries. No independent international observation was allowed, and the CNE also denied accreditation for one of Venezuela's most important independent observer groups to monitor the election. In essence, then, the regime says of the results, "Take our word for it." "We encountered an absolutely fraudulent system," said Carlos Ocariz, the opposition candidate in Miranda, the nation's second most populous state, where the candidate of the ruling Socialist Party won. State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert condemned the lack of free and fair elections, noting the voice of the Venezuelan people was not heard. She said, "Our previously stated concerns were unfortunately realized. Lack of independent, credible international observers. Lack of technical audit for the National Electoral Council's tabulation. Last-minute changes to polling station locations without public notice. Manipulation of ballot layouts. And limited availability of voting machines in opposition neighborhoods." As long as the Maduro regime conducts itself as an authoritarian dictatorship, the United States will work with members of the international community and bring the full weight of American economic and diplomatic power to bear in support of the Venezuelan people as they seek to restore their democracy. The United States continues to call on the regime to provide for the humanitarian needs of its people, respect the Constitution and National Assembly, allow a true democratic process, and release all political prisoners.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.